This is Valor Radio. Valor, strength of mind and spirit that enables a person to face danger with steel-clad resolve and determination in battle or in any other situation. Valor, like that displayed by veterans of every branch of the military throughout our community. This radio show, Valor Radio, salutes all of you who have raised your right hands to volunteer and protect and preserve our unique American way of life. Thanks for joining us and your brothers and sisters in uniform for Valor Radio. Here are your hosts, Colonel Paul Simonelli and Captain Steve Momano. And we greet you once again, soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, Coasties, and Guardians, as well as the civilians serving by their side. Thanks so much for joining us here for another edition of Valor Radio. We have Captain Steve Momano live in studio here.
Howdy.
Good to have you with us. And in our Southern Command, Colonel Paul Simonelli. What's going on there, Colonel?
Hello, gentlemen. I want to get right into this today. I want to take every minute we can. Today, we have the privilege of having retired Army Colonel and historian Greg Fontenot on the line with us. Just to set the stage, we're going to talk about his most recent book, No Sacrifice Too Great, the 1st Infantry Division in World War II. This isn't Greg's first book, and everyone he does keeps getting better. And he's going to tell us why the 1st Infantry Division and some of those other things. But in trying to capture what the 1st Infantry Division did in World War II in a single volume must have been a tremendous challenge. You're talking about a unit that was involved in 9 campaigns, had a casualty rate in excess of 200%, had young men that entered the war as second lieutenants and rose to the level of battalion commanders. Just unbelievable what this division was able to do. I know Greg's biased, so he's going to say that he thinks 1st Infantry Division was the best. I think Dwight Eisenhower thought that 3ID, my former unit, was the best. But we'll agree to disagree, and I probably defer to Greg on that anyway. Greg, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me. And I wasn't there, so I defer to Ike's judgment. I think he was mistaken, but I can't prove it. the point is, the real story here isn't just the 1st Infantry Division. The 1st Infantry Division, like the 3rd Infantry Division, like the 2nd Infantry Division, like the 32nd Infantry Division, like the 77th Infantry Division, was, by the end of World War II, nothing like what it began. The 1st Infantry Division began as a regular Army division, but it, like all the other divisions, was cadre. That is to say, some people were taken from the division and moved elsewhere to leaven the experience that was available. And we built divisions by cadre, so that when you look at raise in the Army, the primary thing to remember in the interwar period is, despite the fact that the Army was allowed to decline to just under 250,000, we never manned any of our units properly. We had the structure to expand rapidly. The National Defense Act of 1920 generated 9 Army Corps areas, each of which had was planned to have 6 divisions, 1 regular Army division, 2 National Guard divisions, and 3 Army of the United States or reserve divisions. As I recall, we actually only had 8 regular Army divisions, so the Corps areas weren't all the same. But the point is, that gave you the capacity very rapidly to build up the 54 divisions if you had all 9 Army Corps properly manned. As a consequence of that structure being present, in September 1940, when the draft was passed, that enabled the Army to expand rapidly. By the end of 12 months, in a little over 12 months, there were more than 1 million in uniform and 29 divisions activated in training before Pearl Harbor. And with that, I'll stop for a second in case you have a question or a comment you want to make, Paul or Steve.
Well, just a brief one, because I want to listen to you. what you can't read this book and not come away with, And you set it out right up front, which is always the way it was dealing with you. This book is not only about the valor of this unit and the willingness of these folks to live by the motto of the 1st Infantry Division, but it was really a testament to the ability to train and to learn and get better for every experience that they had. Like you said, it was a very different division at the end of the war than it was in the beginning.
Exactly. My thesis is in the very first sentence of the introduction, and I'll just take a second to read it. This book is based on a simple proposition that the U.S. 1st Infantry Division, familiarly known as the Big Red One, adapted to dynamic battlefield conditions through the course of its employment during World War II by innovating and altering behavior, including tactics, techniques, and procedure. And that is true, in my opinion, of the vast majority of the U.S. Army's 89 divisions that were created in World War II. And before we get into how did they do that, I want to remind the audience that however robust an army appears to be, however successful it is in combat, armies are ephemeral. They're easy to take down and much harder to build up. We were fortunate in the interwar period in fact, in the beginning of the war, that there was a buffer zone between us and the war, you know, the two oceans that we had. We didn't get involved in the war until 1941, but we had, thanks to the leadership of the president and the cooperation of the Congress, had prepared for the transition. So the problem of maintaining tactical excellence, which the 1st Infantry Division did, as did the 3rd Infantry Division. Eisenhower, by the way, mentioned several other divisions for excellence, the 45th, the National Guard Division, and the 30th, both received mention. The 90th Division, an Army of the United States division, a reserve division, also was perceived to be an excellent division, though it started out with a rather poor reputation. Why do you need to adapt and constantly innovate? You need to do that because 206% casualty rate between D-Day and the end of the war increases the increased turbulence by also causing replacements to have to be made, and people got promoted and moved. So a staff sergeant squad leader gets killed, a buck sergeant or somebody has to move up and take their place. If a lieutenant colonel is a successful battalion commander, there may be a requirement for a regimental commander in the division or elsewhere. So you have, quote, normal turbulence also. And the way that they did this is something that the Army calls now, we call after-action reviews. In World War II, they called them critiques. And a critique was the same idea. What did we do right? What did we do wrong? And how do we improve it? And that means developing a system of lessons learned. But a lesson is only learned if it in fact adjusts behavior. If you record a lesson and do nothing about it, then you've learned nothing. The other thing that's related to this is the absolute necessity to integrate and train replacements in such a way that they are prepared enough to learn how to survive, and they have to do this pretty quickly. When able, the 1st Infantry Division and others had what they called battle schools, where they would bring in new soldiers, educate them on the traditions and the lineage of the division. And some of that may sound a little silly, but, you know, it was good to know if you were in the 16th Infantry Regiment that your regiment had stood in the line at Antietam. It was an ideal thing in 1940 when the 18th Infantry Regiment had its organization day, which is the day in which they matriculate, if you will, recruits who have been trained into the regiment. The man who was their guest speaker had served in the 18th Infantry Regiment during the Civil War. Yes, during the Civil War. 75 years after the war, there was a guy left alive who could talk about it. So that lineage and tradition of the unit is part of it. Things like mottos sound silly, but they actually matter. I just came back from the 104th Officers' Dinner of the 1st Division, which the division's 102 24 years old, but there have been 104 dinners where the officers of the division got together to celebrate their lineage and tradition. The motto of 1st Infantry Division is no mission too difficult, no sacrifice too great, duty first. Well, what's crazy is soldiers in the 1st Division actually came to believe that. When you think about it, it's nuts, but soldiers believe in that stuff.
All right, and with that, Greg, we're going to have to take a quick break here. Sit tight, and we'll be back after we pay some bills here on Valor Radio.
It's the WISL stations. You've got the Colonel Paul Simonelli down in the Southern Command, the South Florida studios of WISL. Captain Steve Amato here in studio. We'll be back with more with Greg Fontenot and you on WISL.
Your go-to for standard of specialized business insurance coverage. MGM Associates of Rochester, now serving the region and beyond in New York. Since 1984, MGM has provided leading coverage from a wide range of carriers. Not only home, condo, boat, motorcycle, and auto, but also specialized policies for all types of businesses, including nonprofits and law firms, livery insurance, property insurance, and bonds for all needs. MGM Associates of Rochester provides auto, workers' comp, health care, and liability coverage. Choose from virtual appointments or good old in-office, in-person consults by appointment at our Penfield office. Five-time consecutive winner of the National Best Practices Award, MGM is proud to support veterans groups. For your personal, business, home, or professional insurance needs, meet the experienced staff at MGM Associates. Locally and proudly owned at 1745 Penfield Road in Penfield, 381-7008, or mgminsure.com. An associate of United Frontier Mutual Insurance, 190 Davison Road, Lockport, New York.
Your stuff deserves a better home. That's why you need to store with confidence at Hidden Treasures Self-Storage in Farmington. Units are safe and secure in a variety of sizes. At Hidden Treasures, there are no locks, no keys, no combinations. Bluetooth locks are controlled by your cell phone. Get 50% off your first month. Convenient to everywhere on Loomis Road in Farmington. Close to the thruway. Get peace of mind when you stow your stuff at Hidden Treasures Self-Storage.
It's the Geneseo Air Show, July 13th and 14th. F-22 Raptor, B-17, B-25s, Warhawk, Hurricane, Spitfire, Mustangs. It's not too early to buy tickets. See NationalWarplaneMuseum.com.
Baseball, hot dogs, and the American flag. They're all part of the rich fabric that makes our country great. Show your American spirit by purchasing your flag from the Stars and Stripes Flag Store today. When you do, you are supporting critically needed services for local veterans at the Veterans Outreach Center. Let's show our veterans that we care by placing our nation's symbol on the porch of every house in our community. The Stars and Stripes Flag Store, 783 South Avenue.
From Niagara Falls to the Adirondacks and from Canada to Pennsylvania, you're listening to Valor Radio.
Radio on the WISL stations is brought to you by A.M. Ginsburg & Associates, the law firm of Christopher Johnson, Taylor Heating and Air, call 500-HELP, Hidden Treasure Self-Storage in Farmington, MGM Insurance, and the National Warplane Museum. And once again, we toss it to our compadre, Colonel Paul Simonelli in Florida. Paul?
Thanks, Robert. So, Greg, right before the break, you were talking about how important knowing the lineage and the history. And I know you probably aren't going to be happy, but I just want to step away from the book just for 2 minutes, if I could, please. It seems that there appears to be an effort, and whether it's coordinated or not, to eliminate some of our history from the young people that are coming up right now. And, you know, we can talk about whether we agree with it or not, but for instance, you know, changing all the names of these bases that happened to be named after Confederate generals, you know, changing the name of buildings at West Point and other places. Do you think that has a negative impact on some of that, creating that historical feeling and buy-in from people coming into the service now?
I don't know because I'm not close enough to units to know that. But I think some of that was unnecessary, but I don't really have a problem with renaming those bases. The problem I have is if you take the whole idea to the extreme that you judge people on the basis of contemporary morality and contemporary ideas, then you really are committing what historians call the fallacy of anachronism. You're trying to impose, you're trying to make judgments about people who lived in a time in which the things that we now believe simply weren't true to them. So I don't particularly have a problem with it. I just don't know that I think it was necessary. To the extent that we teach history not as a balanced approach, which, you know, I learned about, the problems with the American Indian and Manifest Destiny, interment of the Japanese, the civil rights, you know, without ever having to be indoctrinated, I was taught that American history was not, you know, all justice and light, that there were things that we did or happened on our watch that we wouldn't be proud of. But, you know, I was taught on balance this was a good country, and I still believe that. And I think that where I differ from what I call the woke folk is they confuse the ideal with reality, the idea that the United States is somehow bad and, you know, worse than other places is, of course, absurd. And, you know, proof of that is 10 million people so far in the last 3 years have tried to come across, yes, for economic benefit, but also because of pride of place. And this is a great place to live and work. So I hope that answers your question.
No, I think it does. And I think it's a balanced answer. I know I spent a majority of my time being assigned to units at Fort Bragg, now Fort Liberty. Bragg will always be Bragg to me, you know, so, and I just think it's a symptom, too. I think it's, I don't think it affects the new people coming in, but I think the people that are there, it's always something that sort of sticks in the back of your mind. I don't know. Let's get back to the book, though, because with the military, lineage is so important. A quick aside, when I arrived at your brigade and to the battalion I arrived at, one of the first things then Lieutenant Colonel Cucullo did was sit us down and tell us the complete history of the battalion. And that was, I was watching the faces of the young soldiers, and what you say is, you know, that really was, it did have an effect on them. So,
yeah, I think, Napoleon said that people will fight and die for a little bit of ribbon. The truth is, soldiers don't fight for some lofty idea. They may enjoy the army for that, but they fight because they belong to a unit and they belong to something that's bigger than themselves. And to that end, let's get back to how units learn. I wrote a chapter on Tunisia, the subtitle of which is The Wehrmacht as Tutors. And one of the best lines I read from a soldier in the 16th Infantry, Robert L. Bogart, said that, quote, at Kasserine Pass, we got the hell kicked out of us. The German Panzer Army Africa smacked into the Kasserine Pass with the intention of deranging, if you will, the American assembly areas. We were assembling in the Kasserine area to continue the attack. And the Terry Allen described what the Germans did as, quote, the German panzers came boiling out of the west end of the pass and with a whiplash of tanks, guns, and men, knocked the American forces reeling back beyond the mountain passes at Sabetlef and Kasserine, 40 miles west of the Fade Pass. Well, this was an enormous shock. You know, these guys had trained. They had successfully done the invasion of North Africa. They had succeeded in most of the fighting in the time leading up to this, and then they got swamped. Well, the good news is, after they recovered, and they did recover, and they did turn the Germans back. They had a chance to be taken out of the rear or taken into the rear and refurbish, refit, retrain, and they did that. Some of the lessons learned were kind of obvious. One sergeant said the chief thing that he learned was dig in fast below the level of the ground. Another sergeant said we dig foxholes on the sides of hills and cover the tops for protection against artillery fire. All fairly straightforward, but you have to figure out a way to inculcate that in those who didn't experience it. So the next thing that they did is they established battle schools where, among other things, they taught folks the lineage and tradition of the unit, but also basic skills, and they taught young infantrymen that they could survive being overrun by tanks and take up shots on the tanks' rears as they went by. And one of the things they put in the book is a picture of a critique, what we would call an after-action report. And in the back rank of those sitting at this critique or after-action report as they go through it is Ernie Pyle, a reporter who famously loved the 1st Infantry Division. And I guess the point is they learn from these things. And Eisenhower, who was the Allied commander, issued a general order saying, I am going to make it a fixed rule that no unit from the time one reaches this theater of war until the war is won will ever stop training. This includes units in the front line. And you may remember that there was some grousing about training in Bosnia while we were doing the mission. But one
Absolutely.
Of the great lessons learned is you never stop training because things change, dynamic things happen. And training is an absolute necessity, and that means not only training, but training to a standard or testing people on what they allegedly have learned. And I think that's the key thing that made the United States Army successful. Rommel put it this way. He said the Americans, quote, could not yet be compared with the veteran troops of the 8th Army. Yet they made up for their lack of experience by their far better equipment and their tactically more feasible command. He said they'd also, the tactical conduct of the enemy's defense had been first class. They had recovered quickly after the first shock and soon succeeded in damming up our advance by grouping their reserves to defend the passes and other suitable points. Not a bad grade from the Desert Fox for the 1st Infantry Division and other American troops in Kasserine.
Really?
With that,
yeah.
I'd ask if either of you have any questions or comments you'd like to make.
Well, I wanted to... I want for most people that haven't read your book yet, I'd like you to just spend a few minutes talking about scope. You know, any of us that have done any historical reading about World War II have a sense of it. But what I enjoyed about the book is while you're talking about these big picture items, you were able to also personalize them with some of the folks you got to speak to or whose papers you were able to look at. And so if you could, just take a couple minutes to talk about a soldier's view entering the division and being taken up to the front line.
Well, about 1 minute, by the way, just so you know.
Okay, we can do that quickly. First of all, let me set the context, and then after the break, we can talk about some of the soldier stories. When I write a book, what I try to do, especially with World War II, is make sure the reader understands how did the Army expect to fight? That's doctrine. How were we equipped to fight? That's the equipment. And how were we structured to fight? That is, how were units organized? So it's important for me to lay out squads, platoons, companies, how these things all fit together, and a little bit about what the concept for operations was. And yes, let's talk after the break about some of the soldier stories.
That would be great. Once again, we're talking with Greg Fontenot. We're talking about his book, No Sacrifice, Too Great. And we're going to take a short break here on Valor Radio. When we come back, more with Greg Fontenot, Steve, and Robert.
And you're listening to Valor Radio on the WISL stations, 92.1 FM, 95.5 FM West, AM 1040, and always online at WISL1040.com. We'll be back right after the break. Don't go away.
we don't have it no more. Reading your letter, I didn't know whether to call you up and talk again. When I saw the name you signed, going through my mind was a memory of way back when. Now all that I can wish you is good luck, baby. Sorry that it...
From Niagara Falls to the Adirondacks and from Canada to Pennsylvania, you're listening to Valor Radio.
We are back in here, Valor Radio, on the WISL stations. We've got a full studio today, but I'm going to toss it to our Florida studios and to Colonel Paul Simonelli to bring us in for this segment. Paul?
Thank you, Robert. So before the break, we were talking about the structure of your writing, and once again, I think one of the real enjoyable things for readers is whenever you're able to bring in individuals or information about different individuals, and even the few times you get to talk to some of those folks while you're doing your writing to get a firsthand account. And I thought you might want to talk a little bit about that during this segment.
I do, because we were, the three of us, you know, had an aside during the break. We were talking about what was it like to serve and who were these people and what were they like. So let's take a second or two to talk briefly about that in the context of how do you integrate replacements. At the end of the North African campaign in Algeria and Tunisia, they had organized rest camps and organized training so they could take the lessons, you know, capture them, write them down, and then execute the training to bring everybody up to speed. But that wasn't the case in all instances. After D-Day, the troops in the field were so busy, the Army was so busy, there were very few times where they could get out of the front line and spend a week or 10 days, you know, doing R&R and training people. So sometimes they had to make short shrift of that. They had to take it a different way. I got to interview a guy who, by the way, is 100 years old, was just at the opening this weekend of the 1st Infantry Division Museum at Fort Raleigh, Kansas, Staff Sergeant Jim Sharp. Jim was from Kansas, enlisted in the Army, do his bit. He went up in January of 1945 in the back of the 1st Sergeant's Jeep. He and another guy sitting in the back of the Jeep. 1st Sergeant's trailer had hot food in it, and they were hauling it up to feed the his company. So when they got up within about a half mile of the forward line of troops, they were unloaded and the food was handed out to various soldiers. And Sharp and his buddy were brought by the squad leader, their squad leader, up to the front line. And they were put in an empty foxhole. Neither of them needed to ask why the foxhole was empty. So they accepted their lot. They got in the hole. This is about 2 in the morning. And the staff sergeant, squad leader, Sergeant Zillich, said, "I'll be back to pick you guys up. We attack at 0400. And so they had 2+ hours. Anyway, by the time Sergeant Zillich got back to get him up, Sharp had fallen asleep in the foxhole. So he was on his watch. The other guy had managed to stay awake. The sergeant woke Sharp up and said, "You know, this is ordinarily a court-martial offense, but since this is your first night in the field, we're going to let that go, and you stick with me. I'm going to get you through these first few days." Zillich did, and Sharp ended the war as a staff sergeant squad leader himself. As an irrelevant aside, but a very interesting aside, Sharp was a sergeant of the guard during the Nuremberg trials, and like a lot of those guys who were doing that, the 26th Infantry Regiment of the 1st Division pulled the guard for that. He collected the autographs of all these guys who were being tried for war crimes. So he showed me his autographs of, you know, Alfred Yodel, best wishes on your military career. Hermann Göring, good luck in the service. You know, it was just kind of remarkable.
Hey,
Sharp was typical of the kind of American soldiers that you got. Typical only in that it was a diverse force, but you had most of these folks willingly served, and they ran the gamut from people like Sharp to people like Thomas O. Beauchamp, who joined the 1st Infantry Division in 1917 as a logistician and retired from the 1st Infantry Division in 1955 after 38 years continuous serving in the 1st Infantry Division. So that's the one side of the coin, the continuous service that passed on the traditions and skills and lessons learned to people like Sharp, but also to one of my favorite characters, a man named Swinken. And Swinken knew why he was fighting. Michael Swinken was part of B Company, 1st Battalion, 16th Infantry Regiment. I have a picture of him in the book. And if you look up Michael Swinken on the Internet, this picture will come up. And it's Swinken sitting on a box of some kind. He's got his M1 Garand rifle with a part of a K-ration box covering the barrel because it's wet and rainy. He's smoking a cigarette, and he's got the look on his face of confidence, and he knows why he's there. A couple of hand grenades, a life vest because he's going to be crossing the R-O-E-R, Ruhr River, and some flares, all the combat paraphernalia. Swinken was a Jewish soldier. He knew why the hell he was there and what he had to do. Swinken made it through the war, died in the early 2010s. Great story, in my opinion. And one of my other favorite guys is a guy named Momini, and I want to mention him because the standards of fitness required to get in the Army and medical standards, height, weight, that kind of thing, were such that they reflected the inconsistency of health in the country. People forget that in the contemporary era, that in the interwar period, during the Depression, pellagra, beriberi, and a couple of other strange diseases and malaria were not uncommon in the United States. Food insecurity and undernourishment was a problem for the Army. I think we talked about it once before. The Army had a standard. I can't remember how many teeth it was. I think it was either 12 or 16. But they had to be opposing teeth so that you could chew your food. Even so, with all of those kinds of things going on, out of the first million men drafted, 100,000 had to be let go. Illiteracy was not uncommon. English as a second language was not uncommon. So when you think of the Greatest Generation, they aren't the Van Johnson-looking guys necessarily that you see in movies. One of these guys I really happen to like was a man named Momini. He was too short in 1941 when he tried to enlist for the Army, the Navy, the Marines, or anybody. In 1943, he was just tall enough to carry an M1 rifle in the 1st Division. Momini was 5 feet flat tall. That's pretty short. When you put an M1 rifle with a bayonet on the end of it, the rifle was taller than Momini was. Momini went ashore on D-Day, June 6, 1944, in water well over his head, and he sunk immediately to the bottom. He pushed himself off. He'd get a gasp of air, sink back down, push himself off until he got to the beach, and then made it across the beach and fought the rest of the war successfully. His platoon leader, who was no taller than he was, called Momini Shorty. But the point I'm making is Americans, you know, ran the gamut. The average size soldier at that point was 5'9". They wore 9.5 shoes and wore and weighed 165 pounds. So you're not talking about really big men compared to where we are today. Anybody have a comment or question?
Well, I'd like to give you a story. My dad was an MP in Berlin after the war, and his commanding officer, the colonel, had been the provost marshal of 1st Infantry Division on D-Day at Omaha Beach. And he caught one of his men who was on guard duty sleeping. And that's why you mentioned the thing about a court-martialable offense. It was a serious offense. And he was in big trouble. And just before the invasion happened, he decided to press all these guys in service. And he let this guy go in with the first wave. And when he was in the landing craft going ashore at Omaha Beach, he looked over and there was the fellow carrying a bazooka. And he looked at him and the guy said, I'm going to get me a tank for the major. And he was one of the first guys who got shot in the face. He said, I always think about that guy and maybe I should have kept him. I could have court-martialed him, saved his life.
You know, the thing is, when you doing a kindness for someone, as the provost marshal did, may later on redound to their misfortune. But on the other hand, serving 3 or 4 years in Leavenworth, you know, for
right.
something that young men often do, fall asleep when they're not supposed to, was not something that the Army was particularly inclined to do. And the Army had learned, the regular Army in particular, had learned from the interwar period service with the Civilian Conservation Corps. In the Civilian Conservation Corps, you had the soldiers they would lead in the draftee army that was going to win World War II. And that's an important point. World War II was not won by professional soldiers. It was won by citizen soldiers.
All right, Greg, we're going to have to take a break right now. And we'll be back shortly, and we'll continue with our discussion.
The Colonel, the Captain, and Greg Fontenot back in just a moment on WYSL and Valor Radio.
Your go-to for standard of specialized business insurance coverage, MGM Associates of Rochester, now serving the region and beyond in New York. Since 1984, MGM has provided leading coverage from a wide range of carriers, not only home, condo, boat, motorcycle, and auto, but also specialized policies for all types of businesses, including nonprofits and law firms, livery insurance, property insurance, and bonds for all needs. MGM Associates of Rochester provides auto, workers' comp, health care, and liability coverage. Choose from virtual appointments or good old in-office, in-person consults by appointment at our Penfield office. Five-time consecutive winner of the National Best Practices Award, MGM is proud to support veterans groups. For your personal, business, home, or professional insurance needs, meet the experienced staff at MGM Associates. Locally and proudly owned at 1745 Penfield Road in Penfield, 381-7008, or mgminsure.com. An associate of United Frontier Mutual Insurance, 190 Davison Road, Lockport, New York.
Your stuff deserves a better home. That's why you need to store with confidence at Hidden Treasures Self-Storage in Farmington. Units are safe and secure in a variety of sizes. At Hidden Treasures, there are no locks, no keys, no combinations. Bluetooth locks are controlled by your cell phone. Get 50% off your first month. Convenient to everywhere on Loomis Road in Farmington. Close to the thruway. Get peace of mind when you stow your stuff at Hidden Treasures Self-Storage.
As a veteran of the United States military, I can finally get the opportunity to enjoy special events, things that we couldn't afford, thanks to VetDix.
Every empty seat at a concert, a game, or a play is a missed opportunity to say thanks to a veteran and service member. We can give our veterans a special event where they too can create their own cherished memories. Visit VetDix.org. Find out how you can make a difference in a veteran's life.
Baseball, hot dogs, and the American flag. They're all part of the rich fabric that makes our country great. Show your American spirit by purchasing your flag from the Stars and Stripes Flag Store today. When you do, you are supporting critically needed services for local veterans at the Veterans Outreach Center. Let's show our veterans that we care by placing our nation's symbol on the porch of every house in our community. The Stars and Stripes Flag Store, 783 South Avenue.
Don't miss the annual antique show and sale at Genesee Country Village Museum in Mumford, New York. Coming up Saturday, May 11th, explore the museum grounds and hunt for antique treasures curated by dealers from around the region. Shop 19th and 20th century wares as well as handcrafted goods by local artisans that make connections to trades of the 1800s. Tickets include full museum access. Learn more and buy tickets now at gcv.org.
You're listening to Valor Radio with Colonel Paul Simonelli.
Valor Radio on the WYSL stations is brought to you by A.M. Ginsburg & Associates, the law firm of Christopher Johnson, Taylor Heating and Air, call 500-HELP, Hidden Treasure Self-Storage in Farmington, MGM Insurance, and the National Warplane Museum. Once again, here's the Colonel.
Thanks, Robert. And when we left off, Greg, you were talking about the war was won with, I don't want to say an amateur army because they proved themselves professional in their trial by fire. But the point being, these weren't career soldiers for the most part. And I would like you to talk a little bit about, because it seems important, the senior leadership, you just don't pin stars on individuals or or eagles and expect them to perform. And the military, the Army in particular at that point, had a pretty good educational system for their officers. And it paid off. It showed that it worked in World War II, didn't it?
It did. And we also had, as a consequence of the end of the century, turn of the century, John McCauley Palmer and some others were interested in some kind of universal military training so that every young man in the United States would take soldier training. That did not come to pass, but they had there was a program often called the Plattsburgh Project, because some of it took place at the regimental headquarters and the brigade headquarters in which the 26th Infantry was, which was at Plattsburgh in Plattsburgh, New York. Later, Plattsburgh was an Air Force base. But a lot of people went through that kind of training at Plattsburgh and elsewhere, which they received no payment for. The Army would feed and house them while they trained, but that was it. So you had a small cadre of people who did that. You had another group of people who joined the National Guard. And bear in mind, there were 9 corps areas, each of which had 2 National Guard divisions. So there were 18 divisions in the New York. The Regular Army Division was the 1st Infantry Division. The 2 National Guard divisions, I can't remember the second one, the first of the two was the 27th. And there were 3 Army of the United States divisions, the most well-known of which is the 77th, which features the Statue of Liberty in gold on a blue field. So you had these opportunities, and people would join the National Guard in the 30s because it gave you a few bucks, and you had a weekend or so a month where you had you got to bond with your neighbors, and so there was a small cadre, but an important cadre of folks that were trained. One of the guys who went through the Plattsburgh system fell in love with the 26th Infantry Regiment and the 1st Division, wound up commissioned in 1940, and by the end of the war, he had command of battalion. Then you had people like John T. Corley, graduated from the United States Military Academy in 1938, joined the division in 1940. In the spring of 1942, he became a major, promoted to major, and became the battalion commander of one of the battalions of the 26th Infantry Regiment. And he commanded them through the end of the war. Corley won the Distinguished Service Cross as a battalion commander, and later in Korea won a 2nd Distinguished Service Cross as a regimental commander. One of my favorite characters, actually it's one of Steve Romano's favorite characters, let's just mention Terry Della Mesa Allen, Terry Allen, and his artillery commander during his tenure as division commander. Allen's artillery commander was a man named Cliff Andrus. At one point, Andrus and Allen found themselves living close by each other at Fort Apache in Arizona, where Allen's father was the local artilleryman and Andrus's father was the cavalryman commanding the post. These two guys were a little rambunctious. They got into trouble, and the fathers decided to turn them over to an Apache chieftain for 2 weeks, and they went to live as Apaches for 2 weeks. And I don't know exactly what happened there, but they came back reformed.
Maybe that's why Terry Allen likes sleeping on the ground.
Yeah, it could be. They came back reformed, and Allen and Andrus determined they would both enter the Army, but Allen and Andrus agreed that each would enter the opposite branch of the father. So Allen, the artilleryman's son, became a cavalry officer, and Andrus, a cavalry officer, became an artilleryman. Andrus later succeeded Clarence Coach Huebner as commander of the 1st Infantry Division and ended the war as a CG 1st IB. Quick story about Huebner. Huebner's from a small town here in northeast Kansas, graduated with insufficient funds to go to college, so he went to business school where he learned, among other things, stenography and typing. Later on, he enlisted in the Army as a private, where he became you know, a prized possession because he could type and he could do stenography. Eventually he got a commission. By the end of World War One, he had been a decorated commander of a battalion in the 1st Infantry Division, so he had history with the 1st Infantry Division. Probably most folks or some folks will know that Teddy Rogers,
Ted Roosevelt.
I've lost my mind. I can't think of the Teddy Roosevelt Jr. was in the Assistant Division Commander of the 1st Infantry Division. He had commanded a battalion of the 26th Infantry Regiment in World War One. Had been very badly wounded. He got out of the Army, served as Governor General in both the Philippines and Puerto Rico, came back into the Army when the war began, actually applied to his distant cousin, Franklin Roosevelt, to get back in. They allowed him back in. He commanded the 26th Infantry Regiment. Then he was Assistant Division Commander. Later on, he went ashore with the 4th Infantry Division as a supernumerary brigadier general to assist, and they had planned to put him in command of the 90th Division, and he died of a heart attack before they could do it. So you had an army, come back to the point, you had an army of citizen soldiers. You did not, everybody didn't go to West Point, but they all eventually went to places like the Staff College or the Infantry School, and those professional military education programs were very effective in training a small army, the officers of a small army, in how to operate at big army levels. At Fort Leavenworth, they learned to maneuver division corps and field armies, and there were even the divisions in our army were not manned. So they learned the theory of doing it, and then they learned it in practice at places like the Louisiana maneuvers and the Carolina maneuvers. So I'll turn it over to you two guys if either one of you have a question or comment.
Yeah, I just got to jump in here, too. Greg, we got about 2 minutes, gents. So whoever wants to speak, go ahead.
Steve?
Oh, well, I'll tell you what. I just want to say that when I think of the 1st Infantry Division, I think of two things, teamwork and leadership by example. Teamwork in the sense that you get a guy like Allen, who is from his background, and Ted Roosevelt, who's from Oyster Bay, Long Island, and they meshed pretty well together. I mean, they had a great relationship, and they won. I mean, they were the first basically victors of World War II in that area of the world. So I think they imparted teamwork into their own people, and it lasted the entire war, 443 days of combat. And then the other thing is leadership by example. And again, a guy like Allen kept his headquarters close to the front during the war, always was available. His men loved him because he was there. He was physically there. And you can't get better leadership than the 1st Infantry Division, including Clarence Huebner, who there was no bitterness with Allen when he was relieved and sent on to the 104th because Huebner was such an outstanding leader.
That's right. Well, Greg,
that's a great point. He was Huebner was a very good leader, and he could do the things that he wanted the soldiers to do. There's a quick vignette. He's one of the troops is watching him demonstrate how to shoot, and he says to his boss, "Wow, the old man knows his stuff." But that's the other piece of this. These guys not only were inspirational, but they were technically competent.
Here you go, Greg. We're going to have to leave it there today. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about your new success, your new book, No Sacrifice Too Great. Thank you again. We'll be back. We'll have you back on the show soon. Folks, let's keep our soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, and Coasties and our guardians in your thoughts and your prayers. Have a great week, and we'll see you next week on Valor Radio.
My responsibility, yeah, I'm real good on the pressure, being all that I can be.